Hi, thanks for joining us. I'm Chrissy Mernon. My guest today is Rebecca Fisher. She's on her book tour. She's from California. Her book is All the Wrong Places, and it's set in a funeral home because does it mirror your life?
It does.
And it's Write What You Know, and is that your book?
That's my book.
Okay. Well, you are an English teacher from California.
So, yes.
So tell me about yourself.
About myself. Well, I've always loved literature. I've always written something. And I think at about 12 years old, my grandmother sat me down and read Jane Eyre with me. And that was the beginning of my experience with a young woman who is struggling through her surroundings, her world, and having to overcome that. And I just fell in love with that. And I think that really sparked my love of books, and that just continued to grow. And eventually, when I got to college, I took a lot of creative writing courses and started to write stories. And this story about my time in a funeral home came to the surface, and once it started, I couldn't stop it, and here is the novel.
And here you are. So you graduated from college and became a teacher?
I became a teacher, yes.
Yeah. So what was your major?
My major was English literature.
English literature.
So that's what I teach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And so you try and ignite that spark that your grandmother...
Oh, yeah. I want to see that light go off in all of them with whatever book. And it's different for every kid. Sometimes they completely check out. Most boys don't want to read Jane Eyre, but you'd be surprised. There are some who come back the next day and they're just thrilled. And that's what I live for. That's what I work for.
Okay, we're going to talk about your book and your story. But with kids in high school teaching English, I heard something last night about how texting has really changed the way teens write, and it's getting worse. Do you see that?
I would agree.
Yes. Would agree?
If it's not a girl putting hearts over her eyes instead of a dot, it's them writing the letter U instead of Y-O-U. And it does happen, and they do turn in typed papers that way, and it is just the worst feeling as an English teacher. And so you have to continually remind them that this is not proper English, and you have to know when to use that. And so it's quite a battle.
I would think that it's getting harder and harder for kids these days because that is the way they're writing.
That's primarily how they write. That's how they communicate. And so for them to turn that off is difficult.
How do you overcome that? What do you do?
I don't know that I ever did overcome it. You just have to constantly remind them, and you reward them when they do it right. And obviously they lose points when they use a U instead of Y-O-U.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you just work on it, work on it, work on it.
You just have to constantly work at it.
And how about reading books?
Yeah, that was probably my biggest challenge, was getting them to read. And I've tried every trick, and a kid who doesn't want to read will not read. Mm. And so last year what I did is I read to them in class. We read most of our books together in class because then it was being read and they were right there. And surprisingly, they would look up like, this is actually really interesting. I know, that's why I picked it.
So that was the way to get them into a book, was mm-hmm. to read it to them, read it with them the time you had them.
Yes.
And so did some take it home from there?
Yes, some did. So it was always a handful that you knew could not put it down, and they would read ahead, and that was just a wonderful feeling.
Mm-hmm. Well, so how about you writing a book? Where did that come from?
Oh, boy. Well, the book started as a short story in one of my creative writing courses in college. And the professor wanted us to use this prompt that required we use something from our past and put this character into a difficult situation. And I went home and thought, what am I going to write about? We all have interesting life stories, but we don't really consider them interesting at first. And this picture of this woman, young woman, driving, fleeing from this abusive marriage with her young daughter in the back seat with nowhere to go, that kept replaying in my mind. And I thought, she's running, but I think it needs to be more difficult. So what are we going to do with her? Well, she has nowhere to go, and I'm going to give her somewhere to go. And she loses control of her car, and she crashes into a hillside. And when she goes to seek assistance at the building on top of the hill, it turns out to be a mortuary.
Is it a dark and stormy night?
You know, it is. As cliche as that sounds, and every creative writing professor I had will tell you, do not start with "it was a dark and stormy night." So I didn't write that, but sure enough, you know, she is driving in a dark and dark and stormy night.
So what happens to her without giving it all away?
Well, you know, much like myself, I've taken away just about everything from her. She has nowhere to go, and so she is open to accepting whatever help comes her way, and that help comes in the form of this funeral director who lives in this funeral home, and he offers her a job and a place to live, which is much like my story.
Okay, well, let's shift to your story. Our guest today is Rebecca Fisher. She's on her book tour. Her book is All the Wrong Places. So let's go to your real life. How'd you wind up in a funeral home?
Well, no one ever expects, I don't think, to wind up in a funeral home, and I didn't either. I was young. I was 20 years old. I was newly married and expecting a baby, and we didn't have many options for a place to live, and he was looking for a job that could support a new family. And we were in Los Angeles and kind of running out of options, and he decided he wanted to study mortuary science and was contacted by a family-owned funeral home in Northern California who was going to offer both a job and an apartment. And I thought, oh, great, an apartment. Well, little did I know that this apartment was in the mortuary, literally right off of the hallway, 10 steps away from the embalming room.
So that creep you out?
That really creeped me out. And I immediately said, no, we can find something else. And
you'd rather live anywhere but there.
Anywhere. Yeah. You know, the crazy thought crossed my mind. We could survive in a car. But, you know, the truth was, It was a really good opportunity, and I did hide out inside the apartment for a while, and you know, we moved up there, moved in, and within, you know, a couple months, I was starting to venture out into the building, and I would help after hours, and that's when I came face to face with the realities of death, as you know, from beginning to end, that process.
And that's really, I guess, what we're going to talk about, what, you know, what you experienced it and how working with the dead kind of changed your life.
Yes.
And so what was your since, you know, before you moved and you didn't want to go to this funeral home, what was your impression of what a funeral home was like? And where did you get that impression from?
My only experience at that point with a funeral home was for my grandma's funeral, my great grandma, actually. And I think I was maybe 11 at that point. And so really a funeral home to me was just a place where you go and see your loved one after they pass. And so I was more afraid of it than anything, because I remember my grandpa walking me up to say goodbye to her, and I had to kiss her. And
You know, you don't want to do that.
Yeah, no. I remember the smell made me nauseous. And
and you're sad. I mean, you're heartbroken.
I was sad.
You've
lost. This is a person I adored. You know, played cards with her frequently, even though she cheated. And she was just one of my favorite people. And here she is. And it's really not her. I could tell that immediately. It's not her. You know, they feel lifeless. And so that was my experience, and I wasn't really interested in that. And so, like I said, I did kind of keep myself removed from that for a while. And but I have to say, as human beings, we adapt to just about anything. And I found myself venturing out, and I started by helping with the vacuuming of the chapels, and, you know, you'd collect the flower cards that come in from, you know, for the family. And slowly but surely, I made my way to that embalming room, and it was quite startling. It was a startling experience to see a person, you know, laying there and having to go through in your mind, who is that? What was their life like? How did they get here? I did grieve a lot. Having to go through that reality. This is a person. You would hear the families come in. I never met with them because I didn't technically work there. But, you know, if I was going out to the grocery store, I would frequently pass them in the parking lot. And just there's a lot of grief.
I was thinking they're all sad. Most of them, aren't they? I mean, I would think that it's such a such, you're grief-stricken.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
You are.
You're just that it's a sad, sad, horrible time, and it's difficult, I would think, for most people.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you would just kind of scurry away, huh? You probably didn't really want to contact them, huh? Just
yeah, I didn't really want to be a part of that process. And then, you know, I remember one night, it was really busy. There's a lot of fog in San Francisco, and there was this belief that the fog was the hand of death. And when it would creep over our small town just outside of San Francisco, we would tend to get a lot more bodies. And
yeah. And so, I mean, it really happened?
It really happened that way. I can't explain it. I think that's why they came up with this idea that, you know, the fog is the hand of death. Here it comes. We can expect a lot of calls.
A busy night.
Yeah.
And so it's.
And so it was a busy night, and my husband at the time, you know, I really wanted him home. So the more I helped him, the faster he would get back. Mm-hmm. And so he needed help with makeup. And here's the makeup. Here's the body. Go for it. And I found myself putting makeup on mm-hmm. these bodies, and that was quite an experience. I remember having this fear that at any moment those eyes were going to pop open. Mm-hmm. And she probably wasn't going to like the color of lipstick I was using or something. You know, uh-huh. Your imagination kind of runs wild at that point. So, you know, you're doing makeup, and over time it just becomes really work.
Mm-hmm.
Just a part of daily life, and you do adapt to it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, oh, you know, you need to do this. Mm-hmm. Would you do that? Sure, mm-hmm. you know. And then, but don't you do that in a loving way? I mean, you know, did you project things onto the bodies as far as, you know, I remember when my great-grandma died and you know, I wanted her to look as nice as...
Yes. I was definitely aware of the fact that this process is more for the family. This person's gone. That was something that hit me right away. Whatever made this person what she was, it's gone. And it is a body now. And really what I was worried about was the family. And so I would do the best I could to make sure that this was a nice as it could be experience for the family.
Because you know what people say. I mean, you know, when they mm-hmm. stand in front of you... tell me what they say. I know you know, because you probably heard it.
Right. You know, they would frequently say, that's not my loved one.
That doesn't look like them.
Yeah, that doesn't look like them. But I have to say, my ex-husband was one of the best makeup artists I've seen, and he was able to make them beautiful. And I would frequently hear them thanking him. Thank mm-hmm. you so much. She looks beautiful. And before that, you know, I remember seeing some of them with, like, the typical blue eyeshadow, pink lipstick that a man might
yeah.
think is appropriate. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that was definitely an emotional experience.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would think that you would get some satisfaction out of doing something that brought some peace or, you know, something to them.
Right.
To the living.
Well, it is such a difficult time, and to know that you can make it better in any way possible was really a good feeling.
Whatever yeah. you could do to help.
Yep.
Yeah. Well, so what did working around all, you know, just death, constant death, do for you as far as life and living?
Wow. Well, a few months in, I brought home a brand new baby. And so here I am with this beautiful new life and all the joys that come with that. And right on the other side of the door is death. And I saw many ages and races and faces. And, you know, that contrast was really difficult for me. As a new mom, you have all kinds of fears. They just come with the baby, all this fear and anxiety, and you would die for this thing. There's no question about it. And I don't know if that's a hormone or what. I've read it is, but there it was. And you have death right outside of your door. And so it's a constant threat. And there was a child that came in, you know, a mother who had lost her child. And that was really, really horrible to realize that none of us can escape this. None of us. And I can't protect her from that. Not really.
I know you think you can. You think you can for at least 18 years.
You would at least try.
Right. Yeah. That's your job.
That's your job.
But we don't have any control over. Mm-hmm. We have no control.
No.
We think we have some degree of control.
Right. I think that keeps us sane. Yeah.
Yes. Do the things that we know are safe. But even then.
So that, I think most moms can kind of remove that thought from their mind, like you said, strapping them in and doing everything within your control. But this was right outside my front door, and that was really hard. I grappled with that for a long time. And, you know, I had strayed from my Christian faith. I was raised at Christian schools, and I loved Jesus as a little girl. I remember singing about him all the time. And at some point, probably my teenage years was the beginning of my straying from this path. And I never really thought about it. I didn't think about the afterlife at all. And when you're face to face with a body that is clearly missing something, you start to wonder, what is missing? Where is it? And what does that mean? What does that mean for them? And really, what does that mean for me? And so all these questions started swarming in my mind. And
what'd you figure out? What'd you do? Or did you get help with that?
Well, you know, I started asking questions just to myself or out loud, you know, like, God, are you real? You know, what's happening here to these people, and what's going to happen to me and my daughter, more importantly, at that time. And I found that the more questions I asked, the more answers I would get. And the answers would come from people around me. And those people would share with me their beliefs. You know, sometimes I wouldn't even ask. They would just kind of share with me their beliefs. And the more, you know, the more questions I asked and the more answers I got, I started to realize I was having this conversation with God. And that slowly but surely led me back to my Christian faith. And so, you know, as awful and frightening and disgusting as those experiences in that funeral home and that embalming room were, they actually saved my life.
Mm-hmm. So what did you come to as far as conclusions and,
you know,
answers and peace, maybe?
Yeah, it started with this simple idea that there is something bigger than me out there, and there's something bigger than this person. And that brought comfort all by itself. And then, you know, the question of what is that bigger thing, and going back to my roots as you know, in Christianity. And you know, it took a lot for me to realize, you know, someone posed this question to me, like, all of your power and all of your decisions have brought you here. So don't you think it's about time that you give that job over to someone who can do it better? And, you know, I grappled with that for a while, like, wow, do I really want to give that up? And, you know, the joke was on me because I never really had it to begin with. You know, that's where the destruction comes in. We try to control our lives and we make messes. And so it was a beautiful moment, I'd have to say, when I decided that, you know what, God, you can have it all. And the hardest part to let go of was this little baby. You can have her too. Because it wasn't really an option. He did have her, and mm-hmm. I was just clinging tightly. Mm-hmm. And that brought peace and freedom like I'd never known before. Mm-hmm. And from there, you know, I started saying, what about this Jesus guy, you know? what happens with that? And you know, we're told if you seek, you will find. And I did. I did. And so in this place of death, face to face with it, I found new life. And mm-hmm. I wanted to write about that. Mm-hmm. And so I put this character in the same place I was in, and I allow her to find that.
Okay, so some of the answers are in the book.
Yes.
Our guest today is Rebecca Fisher. Her book is All the Wrong Places, and it's a novel, but it's based on her life. They say write what you know, so
that's right.
That's what you knew. So we're talking about her time in the funeral home, living in the funeral home. So what conclusions did you come to about, people call it the great beyond, the hereafter, mm-hmm. heaven, hell?
Well, for me, I know that through Jesus I'm saved. So I know that I have a place with him. And I know that everyone here has a place with him. And, you know, that causes me grief, too, to see people struggling with that same concern, that same question. And, you know, it's really exciting to see someone get that answer. And it's really heartbreaking to see someone not get that answer. And there were a lot of people in that business who couldn't find that answer. And, you know, when you're face to face with death every day, if death is it, if that's the end of the road, then life seems really cruel and futile. And I watched a lot of people in that business turn to alcohol, turn to drugs. I lived with someone who did that, couldn't deal with this reality and didn't believe in anything after. And so I totally understand. That's quite a depressing place to be.
If there's nothing after this, this is it, this is all?
If this is it, and you're in the business of, you know, dealing with the end of that, it's pretty depressing. And, you know, I feel so grateful that from that I got, you know, this understanding of life hereafter. And it's just tragic to see people fall apart when they don't have that, but it's a reality in that business.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about living? What did that teach you about living? Did that, because, you know, you just, like I said, you see death every day.
Mm-hmm. And well, yeah, you know, a young person would come in from a car accident, and, you know, again, it's a reminder at any moment your life can end. And so, you know, you can't worry about, always doing things exactly right. You know, I tend to be a perfectionist, and I had to learn to let some of that go and just put one foot in front of the next. And I learned that today is all we have. That's it. We just get today. We just get this moment. And I also have the tendency to worry about tomorrow and stress about yesterday. And
I think a lot of us do.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. I understand that. You bet.
And so every day I have to remind myself, this is it. This is all you get. And it may be frightening to, you know, share your life on a radio station or sit in front of a camera on TV, and it's terrifying. And, you know, all those things start happening. Your heart is racing. And but this is all I get. And if I can share this story with one more person, maybe one more woman who lived in an abusive marriage like I did and had to run from that. If I can share my story of hope with one person today, then I've done my job, and maybe I'll hear, you know, well done.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
mm-hmm.
I'll hear well done.
So there's some enrichment of your life by sharing your story.
Yes.
And it sounds like you kind of conquer fear.
You have to. You know, I lived for a long time under fear, in fear, and it's just not a place to live. You're not really living.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, every day, even on the way over here, I may be afraid, but this is a great opportunity to share my story.
And what about, you know, since it is the time of year where people talk a lot about spirits and stuff, and, you know, some people believe in ghosts or spirits, and some people don't at all, and some people have had unusual occurrences mm-hmm. in their life. And I would think, you know, that being at a funeral home, people think that's where they hang out, the spirits
mm-hmm.
and stuff. So your take on that?
Yeah, I still am trying to understand what I experienced there as far as my Christian beliefs go. I've asked around, and I don't know that I've really gotten an answer. But, you know, I used to doubt, you know, when people would say they saw something, I'd be
mm-hmm.
like, yeah, it was probably a light, right? A flickering light. I don't know. But when I was walking down that hallway outside of my apartment, and there's a mirror at the end of the hallway, and I'm watching something following me, you know, a light kind of floating behind me, and you are just covered in chills and running back to the apartment and locking the door. I don't know how to explain that.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, hearing a footstep outside of my front door, that floorboard creaking, and nobody's there. Everybody's gone home, or they're out picking up, you know, bodies. But there it is. There's a footstep outside of my front door, and I can't explain it. And I think one of the scariest moments was dusting off the hearse. It's late. It's probably 9 o'clock at night. Everyone's gone home. That's one of the duties that needs to be done, dusting off the hearse. It's black and shiny. And I'm in the garage alone, and all of a sudden, in the reflection of the car, I see someone walk behind me and turn around. Nobody's there. And how do you explain that? You know, either I'm crazy and imagining this, or it's really happening. And I'd have to say the funniest incident, although it probably wasn't funny to me at the moment, but looking back, it's kind of funny. It was late, really late, and we hear a loud crashing noise and run out to the small chapel right outside of our apartment door. And the casket that had been open, because there's going to be a viewing tomorrow and the family wanted an open casket viewing, the casket has slammed shut. And we open it and prop it. You know, you pull the little hinge and lock it. And mechanically, this casket was perfect. There was nothing wrong with it. And we test it, and it's locked. And we go back inside. And a few minutes later, it slams itself again. And that happened a few times before we realize perhaps this woman does not want an open casket, and that's the message she's sending.
You say, I mean, yeah, I think I come to that conclusion too. But isn't that kind of freaky too?
That's kind of freaky.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So you'd open it, she'd close it.
That's
somehow,
right.
Somehow it was closed.
That's right.
So
yeah.
Any other stories that just made your hair stand up?
Just more of that. More lights. I would see a lot of floating lights. They're not, you know, lights on the wall. They're floating lights kind of following you. Kind of like if you take a picture and if it's not exposed properly, you'll see a lot of activity. Some people call that paranormal activity. You know, maybe it just wasn't developed properly. I don't know. But mm-hmm. when you're walking down a hallway and you see one of those following you, it makes you really wonder.
Were you afraid, or did you think maybe somebody wanted something? Or do you even know? Can you interpret it?
Honestly, there were times when I felt very afraid and very threatened. And there were times that I just felt kind of curious. So I don't know how to differentiate between the two. Sometimes I didn't feel safe and sometimes I did. It never came into my apartment that I could see, but I do remember when I would be giving my daughter a bath or feeding her, she would frequently look beyond me mm-hmm. and smile as if she were interacting with somebody. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't afraid of whatever mm-hmm. she was looking at. And so I did experience different interactions, I guess you would say. Mm-hmm. And I don't really know how to explain why they were different.
Gotcha on that.
Yeah.
So what do you think of the way the media and movies portray funeral homes? Do you think they they get a fair shake, or it's really way off?
When 6 Feet Under first came out, I think we were still living in the mortuary, and so I didn't really want to watch that. I kind of felt like it was this fictionalized version of my reality.
Right, and I live here. Why?
Yeah.
Why would I need to see it? I didn't really want to watch it.
Yeah. But years later, you know, probably just last year, I watched an episode of 6 Feet Under, and I have to say it was really well done. They really did show the family-owned funeral experience, and I was impressed. But I do laugh whenever they try to recreate death. They'll put a dead body there and they do their best, but the reality is you can't recreate that. Something is missing. There's something to death that you can't recreate, but they do their best. And I just kind of laugh to myself thinking, not really, right?
But close.
Close.
Or you're trying. Good
try. You're trying, yeah.
Okay, well, we're about out of time. Our guest today is Rebecca Fisher. Her book is All the Wrong Places. You're a high school English teacher in California, and you've taken this year off to work on promoting your book,
yes.
on your book tour and stuff. So,
yes.
So what's next for you? Because I'm sure it's a great achievement to finish a book.
Yes. I have a few more stories in the making. Right now, I feel like I've been called to turn this book into a screenplay. I would love to see this on the screen. And so I'm working with someone who actually writes these. And it's been a lot of fun, a little bit hard to kind of let go again, to let them turn this into something different. And so I'm really excited about that.
Well, you're in California. Don't you think your odds are better than someone here in Texas?
Well, the truth is, it seems like everyone on every corner is writing a script. So I hope so. Honestly, I'm here with you today because God has really called me here. And so if that's what he wants, there will be a movie on the screen shortly.
Okay, we'll see. I want to thank you for coming by. And Rebecca, if someone is interested in your book, where do they find it? Where's it's All the Wrong Places.
All the Wrong
Rebecca
Places.
Fisher. It's set at the Golden Oaks Funeral Home.
It's available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the online retailers. And you can also visit my website at RebeccaFisherBooks.com. It's available there, and there's more information about me and And the first four chapters are actually available there
to
download.
So a teaser, huh?
A teaser,
yeah. You're going to get them hooked.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thanks again for stopping by.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And best of luck to you.
Thank you.